someone's right. walking, if someone isn't filling the gap, you get on his case, you say it to him. If I'm walking, I want to hear it. Listen to me now, listen to me. I want them standing back thinking what is going on here. Not for the first 5 minutes, every minute of the game. Manic aggression. Did you scare anyone? Did you put the fear of God into anyone?
All right, on your feet, on your feet.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock on the day that Paul O'Connell, one of Ireland's greatest ever rugby players, announced he has been forced to quit the game. We're going to hear from his very good friend and former Munster colleague Mike Prendergast. We'll also have Donica Ryan, Mark Langdon on European football, Jay McKenna on the Liverpool Supporters Club, ongoing issue over ticket prices, and golf with Gary Murphy as well. That, Gary, is what you call smooth.
Quality intro, right?
Only took me 2 hours to get that down.
You didn't do that.
It was time well spent. 51552 is our text number at GameOn2FM on Twitter, and it is going to be largely about the retirement of Paul O'Connell today. As I mentioned, we've done Donica Ryan, who was at the Ireland press conference earlier today, giving his thoughts about playing alongside him. Mike Prendergast, who knows him very, very well, and we'll hear from the man himself. He spoke to Michael Corcoran a little bit earlier on today. Before we get into that, Gary, I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to answer honestly. How many pancakes have you eaten already today?
Zero.
Zero?
Yeah.
How many are you going to
I've
eat?
I've eaten pretty much everything else, but...
You're not going to go for the old Pancake Tuesday?
Tonight, when I get home.
Apparently in America, it's National Pizza Day. So you put the two together and just call it Fat Tuesday, according to Twitter. It's a new hashtag.
I think every day in America is National Pizza Day. Well, it was when I was there. I went to college there for 2 years and... I came home and one of my mates asked me, was I playing golf for the college or eating for the college?
Well, I was talking to a good friend of mine, Ian Mullally, earlier on. He was driving home from work at 3 o'clock, left work early to go home and make his wife and children pancakes because his wife, Fiona, doesn't cook, who also was a friend of mine.
He was bold at the weekend, was he?
He was extremely bold. He's been bold for the last 5 years of their marriage, I'd say. But yeah, Fiona, yeah. I mean, getting Ian to come home to cook make pancakes for you. Anyway, listen, Paul O'Connell. The news kind of came this morning and it took a lot of people by surprise. But I suppose if you know in the backstory to how much he's been struggling with rehab over the last couple of months, you mightn't have been altogether surprised. Still in all, when one of our greatest ever players retires, it just kind of strikes you, I think. Even though we wouldn't have seen him play for Ireland, the fact that we'll never see him play rugby again, I think it's quite a big deal.
It is. It's very sad, but I think it's one of the things that he did say was he has no disappointment about it. You know, he's achieved everything he's wanted to achieve in the game. I think it's disappointing from my point of view, and I guess from a fan's point of view, that it didn't get a chance to play in Toulon and really cash in on what was a fantastic career. That's just on a personal level. You know, I'd like to see him gone off there, and we discussed it last year. You know, he's a professional athlete, and it's disappointing from that point of view, but to reflect on his career has just been amazing from start to finish. You know, a leader of men. He made, I guess, you know, average players good players and good players great players and led by example. And he really should be very proud of what he's achieved in the game.
Yeah. JJ Casey and McCroom has already been on saying Paul O'Connell was our best leader on the rugby field. Incredible winning mentality. What is it about someone like Paul O'Connell that stands apart, that people just gravitate towards him, that he asks people to do things and they do it happily? As Donica Ryan made the point earlier on, Paul had a way of asking you to do something that you didn't want to do and make you enjoy doing it. That's just the effect he had on people. You know, there are very few people that actually have that.
I think the big thing is that he led by example. You know, it's easy to be, and we've seen, you know, in recent times with all the Lions videos and stuff, you know, guys in dressing rooms roaring and bawling and all that sort of stuff. But when you go out, when you, you know, talk to the talk and walk the walk, and he did that. But I think even from his clip today, you know, this week is the first week that he stopped working. You know, he's known for however long, a week or so, and his diet has changed now. So even just his professionalism from start to finish. And you've seen it with the players that have come through Munster. Like, the tributes to him are remarkable from every corner of the globe. Guys played with him, guys played against him. And I just think it's probably a little underestimated. I think his rugby intelligence as well. The fact that he was, you know, the big marauding second row, but very intelligent and articulate in Even that, you know, that clip there, you know, it's,
yeah,
he's just a great,
he's not standing up in a room full of men shouting, you know, nothingness to try and get them pumped up. There's purpose behind what he's saying, and there's a reason behind the words that he's chosen.
The last match, I can't remember the last game it was, and it was in the, I think, the 78th minute. I think it was one of the games in the World Cup. And, like, he was still, you know, picking the ball and going like it was in the second minute. So when you see someone...
At 36 years of age.
36 years of age. And that's probably what's gone against him. I think if he was 26 or 7, he might have been able to recover from it. But it's just a shame. I'd love to have seen him got a couple of years out of Toulon. But he's been an amazing... I think he's won 14 trophies between Ireland and Munster. And, over, you know, 100 caps. Just amazing. In that position as well. And to be that disciplined, to stay that fit. Because you see a lot of guys that do it, and they, you know, to mind yourself. And I always remember the late Gary Speed. He went home and he slept for 2 hours every afternoon, or lay down for two hours every afternoon, just to rest his body. And, like, that's a phenomenal discipline to just do that.
Yeah.
It's not laziness. Like, that's part of his work. And I'm sure O'Connell was exactly like that. And that's why, you know, I'd equate him to Harrington in the golf, really. I think he gave absolutely everything he had to his sport.
Yeah, we've had a text in. Somebody thinks the timing of this retirement and also the general election is more than coincidence. I think O'Connell should just bite the bullet and run for government. I tell you what, he could be Taoiseach, president, whatever he wants to be if he did go. He'd get every single person's vote, I think. 51552, keep your text coming in. But the great man himself spoke to Michael Corcoran earlier today. This is a flavour of what happened.
I suffered quite a bad injury in the French game, and I knew it was bad right at the time it happened, but all injuries seem bad when they happen right at the time. But, you know, it's probably only in the weeks afterwards I found out how bad an injury it was and how difficult it is to get back from it. So, unfortunately, progress has been very slow for me, and I won't get back to where I was. So I've decided to retire, and I won't be taking on the big adventure in Toulon, which is a big disappointment. And, you know, I had a very enjoyable career, you know, very long career. I look at someone like Felix Jones, who I'd be very close to retiring in the last few months as well, at 28, with so much ahead of him. I consider myself very lucky. You know, it's unfortunate what happened in the French game, but I think I've been very lucky on the whole.
And can I take you back to that afternoon in the Millennium Stadium when it happened? I mean, there was like a shudder around the stadium. I remember I was on the radio at the time and I was making the point that you can tell how serious this is by the number of people who are around you, and B, by the fact that you're not a fellow who kind of rolls around the ground complaining, but you were in agony that day.
Yeah, I was sore, and the pain comes from, with that injury, you get a big swelling when it happens, but the swelling all hits off the nerve, and that's where the pain comes from. You know, I honestly thought right at the time, my career is over, I won't get to go, I won't get to experience France for a year and a half and learn the language and do all the things I was really looking forward to. But I suppose in the weeks after that, I knew a few guys that had rehab the injury and come back from it in a decent time, but I did it a lot worse than a lot of other people seem to have done it, and getting back to where I was just wasn't going to happen, unfortunately, because, you know, it's been a massive part of my life, rugby. You know, even the last week I've noticed my diet already has gone out the door because I've known it myself, and I it's so strange. But yeah, it's been a strange week, but Toulon were great, and it's been a strange week, as I said. Yeah,
Munster fans who are listening to this are going to go, gosh, our prayers have been answered now. Axel with Paul O'Connell, and maybe we can get Rog home as well, and that'll be the new dream team.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, I have a great affinity with Munster, and a great affinity with the coaches that are there. You know, Anthony Foley, Brian Walsh, Ian Costo, Jerry Flannery. It's been a tough time for them, but I suppose they're getting their master's degree in coaching now. You know, it's an incredible experience they're going through. It's tough times, but I'd say it's making them far better coaches. And I think if you want to be good at anything, whether it's coaching or whether it's something outside of rugby, you have to learn the ropes and you have to serve an apprenticeship. And I suppose that's what the next few months and probably a few years will be for me, whatever I do. So if I ever end up doing something with Munster, I'm sure it'll be a long few years down the line yet.
When you look back in your rugby career, I mean, it's a chapter in your life that's lasted for a long time. But given the fact you're going to live for a long time, I would imagine the next couple of chapters, the rest of it, if you understand what I mean, the rest of your life is a blank canvas, but it's a rather exciting journey ahead.
Yeah, it is. It's very exciting. you know, I love playing golf. I literally haven't played golf in the last 3 or 4 years for fear of getting injured. You know, I've literally been avoiding injury and staying on the pitch has been my main focus. So, you know, I'm looking forward to playing a little bit of golf. You know, I'm looking forward to getting back down, watching your Munsters a little bit more. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next chapter. I don't know exactly what that's going to be yet, but that's exciting as well.
Yeah, and that was Paul O'Connell speaking to Michael Corcoran. Well, a couple of texts in. Tony Minute says, lads, just listen to you talking about Paul O'Connell's retirement. The man put a smile on all of our faces over the last few years. He brightened the dark days during the recent recession for us all. He gave us hope when we felt vulnerable. He will be sorely missed, but never forgotten. Well said, Tony. And Jack in Cork as well. Paulie was the most extraordinary player I've seen on a rugby pitch. I'm sorry he didn't get the chance to earn the big bucks in France, but glad he didn't bow out with a serious injury. If you're looking for a real leader, look no further than the young Munsters man. Thanks for that, Jack. And John in Cork says, compare Paulie's honourable values with those of some of our overpaid Premier League prima donnas. I think there is absolutely no comparison. And also, Pan Temple No, and we forgot to say this last night, but we will come back to it hopefully tomorrow, about Temple No's victory. They beat Ardner Dree in the All-Ireland Junior Final on Saturday. It is something we'll come back to tomorrow night. But I'm delighted to say we have Mike Prendergast on the line. Hey, Mike.
How you doing, Hugh?
Good to talk to you. Listen, I rang you earlier on, obviously, to see how you were fixed, and we've been thinking about Paul and his incredible career over the last few hours. It's sad news, but I suppose the tributes that have been flown in all day, Mike, must even be quite humbling for him, I imagine.
They are, absolutely. I went to meet him earlier on, into town for a cup of coffee just to catch up and home myself for a few days, so just to go in and, I suppose, lean a bit of support to him or whatever, but you know, he's the type of lad that he's just looking at, I suppose, what's out there and what's next for him, you know. But he's overwhelmed by the amount of support, even when we were sitting in a coffee shop there earlier on, just the amount of people coming up to him and the text messages flying through and whatnot, you know, and thoroughly deserved as well, you know. He's been huge ambassador for Limerick rugby, for Munster rugby, for Irish rugby, you know.
How hard has it been for him, Mike, you know, the rehab process over the last while, the errors he had to put in without seeing any kind of real return?
Yeah, it's been difficult for him, to be honest with you, especially over kind of the last month or so. I think the first 6 to 8 weeks where there wasn't much he could do. It was just more time and whatnot. And then he was looking for a bit of progression. But unfortunately, it slowed up kind of over the last month, 6 weeks. You know, he's been in contact with Toulon. He's been over and back a bit as well. And you know, he kind of had to, I suppose, make a decision. And the thing with Paul is, just speaking to him early, he would only go on if it's 100%.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it wasn't going to be 100%. So he made the honourable call, you know, of I suppose, not going further and making a decision now for both himself and for his family.
Exactly, because it wasn't, I suppose, if he was on his own and only had himself to consider, maybe he might have kind of, I don't know, pursued a different line or kept pushing it. But because it was very much a family thing as well, I suppose he had to kind of nip it in the bud when he realised it wasn't going to get any better.
Yeah, absolutely. And he would have, you know, he would have given 100%. And I know he did, absolutely, over the last couple of months, because he spent a bit of time up in Santry as well. A bit of time. He was 4 days a week up there getting intensive physio for 4 and 5 hours a day, you know. So
yeah,
he went down, I suppose, every avenue for it to become right. But unfortunately, it didn't. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, that it's a decision, not just a decision for himself, but it's for his wife, Emily, and for the kids as well, you know. So I suppose, look, he's made the decision now, and the next chapter will open, and that's something like he's looking forward to already, you know, whatever it may be, whether he stays in rugby, which hopefully he will, because I just think he's so much to still offer the game, you know, after he hangs up the boots, or whether he goes into business. And I've always said, whatever club or company are fortunate enough to have his services, they'll be a fortunate organisation, you know.
Gary Murphy here is beside me. He's looking forward to taking him on the golf course and taking him down a peg or two. What, he used to be, Mike, am I right in saying he was a scratch golfer or thereabouts? He was one or two? Or
yeah,
maybe?
He was down to about four.
Right, okay.
A brilliant golfer and a brilliant swimmer, actually, as well, in his early days, you know. And that's actually where he got a lot of his discipline, I know, from his swimming days when he was 14, 15. He was up at like 5 o'clock in the morning before school. Train. So that's where he disciplined himself at an early age, you know, and he brought that through with the swimming and the golfing, It led on to rugby, but he was a super golfer. But obviously with the demanding timing with golf, it's very difficult to fit the golf in around it, you know. But I often the odd time when we breaks in season or during the summer, you go out and hit a few balls. I mean, he's just still a natural golfer, and I've no doubt that Gary, when he comes around to play, he'll put it up to you for sure, you know.
I'd love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mike, how bad is his injury? Is he hobbling around or is
No, not at all. He's it's something that just, you know, I suppose if he pushed it, there could be side effects down the ears, you know, or mm-hmm. you know, it's something that would probably bother him because he tore the actual hamstring off the bone, which is quite a severe injury, especially I suppose at the age he's at, you know, he's 36, he wasn't getting any younger.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to be going down to a heavy fixture list down in France as well, you know. So he took everything into consideration, but from that point of view, he's at a level now that, you know, I'm sure that when he goes to play golf or potentially, you know, even five-a-side soccer, he talks about he's looking forward to the days that he can do that. I'm sure there'll be no problem, you know, but at the next level of you know, of rugby to get on to that, to get back to that level, I should say. He just felt he wasn't 100% himself, and you know, he wouldn't like himself, as he says, you know.
I'd say, Mike, they might struggle to get opposition to play five-a-side against him.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. A good centre-back will take the ball from him.
Come here. I remember Brian O'Driscoll as well. When he retired, he spoke about this fat man waiting to get out, so, you know, get out of him when he stopped training. It's nearly the reverse for Paul, Mike, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think he's very disciplined in everything he does, and I don't see it changing a huge amount either, you know. So, you know, whether it be his diet or whatever, you know, he just, through his career, he did everything 100%, and it's something that's, I think as a rugby player as well, it's something that you'd find that when you come out of it, it's quite hard to change. I know some people do it, but you keep quite restricted as well, you know, and I suppose no better man that will do that, I suppose, than Paul will be, you know. And as I said, the next step he takes, whether it be in rugby or in business or whatever, you know, he's a guy that's, you know, he can offer just so much. And also, you know, we speak about, I suppose, the professional and the disciplined player, person he was, and the leader, and he was also a fantastic player, but he's also got a very good sense of humour as well to go with it, you know. And it's something that's, I suppose, I've heard a few players speak about it there in the last day or two about, you know, he makes time for everybody in the squad, whether it's the young guy or the, you know, the more experienced guy. But also, I see it on the street when people come up to him, just how approachable he is, and for people to go up to him, they have no problem with doing it because they know the type of character he is, you know. And he gives everybody time, and he's just a good, genuine bloke, you know.
Bernard Jackman was telling me over the weekend that obviously Grenoble are in the market for a forwards coach. Any chance you might snag him and bring him over there?
Yeah, he'd be a nice catch for us. But look, I don't know. It's something. I asked him today about just what he's going to do in the future, and as you said, he's going to, you know, take 2 or 3 months to dwell over it. I'm sure he'll have no shortage of offers, whether he stays in the game or does something elsewhere. But he just said for now, for the next couple of months, he just wants to, I suppose, focus and spend good family time, think about what he's going to do, and then make a decision, you know. But with open arms, we'd have him. But I'm sure he's, you know, he'd have plenty of options and opportunities.
Do you think, Mike, it puts a little bit of pressure on Anthony Foley with that kind of void available now almost, and O'Gara maybe too?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. I think, you know, Axel's obviously, there's talks that he's there next year, which is something I think that's going to be coming out quite soon, I think. And I think for Paul, I think, being honest, you're just speaking to him, he doesn't know himself what he's going to do, you know. So I'm sure if he's going to go down the rugby route and stay in the game, you know, I'm sure when you have a guy like that who's in your ranks, you're not going to leave him go too easily, you know. But again, it just depends if he's going to stay in the game. And if he does, I'm sure there would be a role somewhere there for him, you know. And obviously he's a very good relationship with Axel, and he's, you know, played with him at Munster in Ireland for a long number of years, you know. And but it just all depends on what route he's going to go down.
Just finally, Mike, while I have you, you know, obviously Ireland and Wales on Sunday, the draw for both teams, in Ireland now have to go to Paris this weekend, and you're living in France. I know you're not there at the moment this week to get the reaction after Italy, but certainly on the basis of what we saw, Ireland shouldn't be overly fearful of the French this weekend. How do you see it going?
Yeah, I see an Irish victory. I don't think a huge amount has changed. I think he's changed some personnel. He's brought in a couple of new faces, like Jonathan Danty, Jules Pélisson, and Nico Bezzi, or Sebastian Bezzi, sorry, at 9, 10, yeah. 12. Especially the 9 and 10, they're two players that like to play with a bit of tempo, like to keep the ball in hand, and that's something that Guy Novis has come out and said, that he wants to bring the French flair back, you know. But it's all well and good saying that, that's one thing, but at this level of rugby, you have to have the structures, and I just think it was a job maybe for him. You know, I've heard it over the last couple of weeks that he should have got maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I'd have to go along with that, you know. I think it's a huge opportunity to go over. I think the game of the weekend that Ireland played against Wales was top quality, top level international rugby, and I think it's something that's going to stand for us going into us this weekend against the French, and I fancy us winning it.
Super. Listen, Mike, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks a million, Hugh. Cheers.
Super.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Mike Prendergast there, obviously former teammate of Paulie's and one of his very good friends, as you can make out from that. A couple of texts in. Paul is a superstar legend, says Michael Gannon Jr. Paul O'Connell is a giant off the pitch, an even bigger giant on the pitch, from Shane in Drogheda. And Paul O'Connell is one fine man. Enjoy the retirement, Paulie. Stand up and fight, says Christine in Dundalk. I don't think you're going to find a single bad word said against Paul O'Connell. We could be here all night.
Absolutely.
It's amazing, that kind of ability just to unify people. Anyway, 51552 at Game On 2FM. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're back with Mark Langdon and European football after these.
Game on 2FM. Weekdays from 7.
And you're very welcome back. Now, Mark Langdon, football editor with The Racing Post, is on the line, as he is every Tuesday night. Hi, Mark.
Hi, you okay?
Yeah, not too bad. Well, not too bad at all. I tell you, have a listen to this. I want to play a quick clip if I can first. This is Burnley manager Sean Dyche speaking on BBC 5 Live about Gary Neville and his time at Valencia at the moment, and his view on Gary Neville taking that job in the first place. Have a listen.
When we got into the Premier League, I thought, he rang me, he wanted to know about what we do, what we try and do, and he really did his homework on us, so I have a lot of time for him for that. I'm amazed he took this job, if I'm honest. I think until you get into the chair, you never know, and it's a tough seat to sit in as a manager at any level, at any club. I try and speak to loads of managers across the board, and to take that one was a real big ask. And some say brave, some use other words. The thing
Which
is,
should
you need
you use?
It's a borderline for me. I understand the bravery, but there's no background. You know, the depth of knowledge is very difficult to come by. You know, I put the miles on the clock in the youth system. I was a development coach. I was an assistant manager. I was a manager. So by the time I got to manage, at least I had a feel of some of the pitfalls, some of the hardships, you know, working closely with managers, understanding some of the angst, the anxiety. He mentioned about anxiety. If he wasn't anxious, for me, anxiety gives you energy. It gives you that knife edge that you have to be on. That's my personal opinion. I get anxious before games, absolutely, because is my planning going to work as it's there in front of me? That's the key thing. When you're sitting with your box of tricks on the TV after the event, looking at games, I think most people can give a good opinion. Now, he's very good at it. After the event, easy. When you're sitting on or standing on the sideline and you've got seconds to debate a decision, how the game's operating, how it needs changing, or sometimes brave to leave it alone, you know, everyone thinks the subs, I get questioned a lot, why don't you put more subs on? Well, because sometimes I think it's more important to leave it alone. All them decisions, for one, they come with experience, and he hasn't got that before he's gone in there. And for two, it's a different thing. It's a completely different thing. The pressure's on, the crowd are there, you're anxious. Well, apparently not, but it's going through, everything's going through your mind 100 miles an hour, and you still have to make the decision. And you know the hardest thing? One of the best expressions I've heard about leading, particularly in football, sometimes it's knowing what to do when you don't know what to do, because you've still got to make a decision. You're the man, you have to make a decision. And at the minute, he said he's enjoying the challenge. I think not. I think he'll be waking up every day going, wow, this is a lot tougher than what I thought. Long answer to your question. When he comes back, if he comes back to punditry, I would imagine there will be question marks.
Well, there you go. That's pretty straight shooting stuff from Sean there, Mark. I mean, he's basically saying that Neville took this job because of his ego. He didn't actually appreciate what he was getting into at the time, and now he's drowning because he doesn't have the experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Sean Dyche has got that absolutely 100% spot on, really. I mean, I think most people were surprised when Gary Neville took the job, because he'd always spoken, really, about wanting to build something, you know, when he finally got into coaching. And here he was taking his first job on a short-term basis in a league he didn't know, with a language he can't speak, with question marks over that his appointment because of his friendship with the owner. It did seem like a strange move at the time, even allowing for all that. I don't think anybody expected Valencia to have made such a bad start under him. You know, he's still not won a game in La Liga. He hasn't actually taken the lead in a game in La Liga yet either. They were beaten by Betis on Sunday. They're only 4 points above the relegation zone. When he took over, they were still aiming to get back into the top four of La Liga. They were still in the Champions League. They were still in the Spanish Cup. They're virtually out of the Spanish Cup. They're out of the Champions League. They've got no chance of getting in Europe next season via their league position. I mean, it's been an absolute nightmare for Gary Neville. The only thing I would say is that I thought he was a little bit unlucky on Sunday. I don't think they deserved to lose the game. It was quite a low-quality match, but I don't think they deserve to lose it. I think he is right to suggest that maybe in the last couple of games, the luck's not been with him in terms of La Liga. But that 7-0 defeat to Barcelona last week just really ramped up, you know, the pressure. And on Monday, the fans were calling for him to go as well.
So the pressure building from the fans, you'd imagine that the owner has to take cognizance of that at some stage. And if he does get the bullet then, Mark, does it damage Gary Neville as a pundit, as somebody who had made huge inroads in terms of the respect that he'd garnered, not just across Manchester United fans, he always had that, but across the entire Premier League, and in fact across the whole of English football?
Yeah, I think there was sort of there were a lot of people that felt he was sort of the next England manager in waiting, because he obviously does the coaching for Roy Hodgson. And I think that was most people's sort of natural idea. I mean, I think they'd be horrified if Gary Neville took the job after what's happened to him now at Valencia. I think that questions will be asked of him as a pundit, but not for long. I think that, you know, initially you would get sort of accusations of, well, you know, you can't hack it, you know, as a manager, so how can you be a pundit? But I think there have been plenty of failed managers that still do a lot of punditry on TV and radio. I don't think it, and I don't actually think that this means that he's going to be a terrible manager forever either. I mean, I think that it will be a good sort of learning experience for him, and I think that when he gets around to another job, and I'm sure he will get another job in England in time, I think he needs to make sure it's the right one and something he can build from, you know, with a pre-season and stuff like that, because he's walked into a job, you know, he's had no pre-season, and they're playing every Saturday and then midweek because of the Copa del Rey, so he's not even really getting to train with the players that often. And I think that that does make a big difference if you can have a whole sort of summer to plan what you want to do.
And there are some very good managers equally who don't seem to be able to express in terms of punditry what it is to kind of hook the viewers in, so that's a unique skill in itself.
Yeah,
Gary,
I think they are completely different jobs. Yeah.
Okay, Gary, you want us to come in?
I think it just shows with, you know, what happened at Derby County yesterday and appointing Neville how crazy some owners are. I mean, it's ridiculous to see the manager go at Derby, and then I guess it's easy to be wise after the event, but like, Neville was so underqualified for a job. And like, how big does your ego have to be to think that you can go to, like, if Trapattoni struggled at Bayern Munich because of a language barrier, having been so successful in Italy as a manager, what chance was Gary Neville ever going to have with no experience?
Yeah, I think there was I think Sean Dyche mentioned that, didn't he, as well, about the ego. And I think there has to be a certain amount of that. And I think from the owners as well, that, you know, basically he's got this friendship and he's put the club in jeopardy, you know, by allowing his friendship with somebody and, you know, wanting to mix with, you know, the class of 92 or whatever it was, you know, has allowed to get into this situation where Valencia, a very good, you know, a very big football team in Spain, it wasn't that long ago, they were winning titles, and now in a relegation battle. I think that there is another problem with Valencia and Peter Lim, and that's his relationship with Jorge Mendes, the super agent, because he's brought in a load of players for big money, and that most of them have been absolutely useless this season. So I think Peter Lim, the owner, needs to take a good look at himself, because you know he's basically building friendships and then allowing those to dictate what goes on at Valencia. And I think that you know you need to have some kind of professionalism, really, that allows you to sidestep those friendships and make the right decisions for a football club.
Mark, do you think this might indirectly affect Ryan Giggs' chances at Man United? Because, you know, can you take a chance on someone because of reputation on the pitch?
I think maybe what's harmed Ryan Giggs more is the fact that Pep Guardiola's taken over at Manchester City, and I think United would rightly be worried about throwing in a complete novice against Pep Guardiola, because most people seem to think that Man City are going to really go for it transfer-wise next year. And if United get their next managerial decision wrong as well, then, you know, how far could they end up behind Manchester City to be, you know, that far behind, potentially behind Manchester rivals, which I think is why there's been sort of this general growing belief that it will be Mourinho, because United feel like they need somebody really big, you know, to take on Guardiola. But I don't think it does Giggs any favours, actually. No, you are right. And I think that Giggs probably now is best served trying to find a club that I just mentioned, for all the reasons that Neville should take, you know, a lower one. I think that maybe Giggs, you know, should do the same and show that he can do the job before he gets something that big.
Okay, just before we go, we're going to touch on the Liverpool ticketing story in our next item, Mark, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it about the walkout over the weekend. And equally, there's a similar kind of protest going on in Dortmund tonight, is that right?
Yeah, there is. Dortmund have got a German Cup quarter-final away at Stuttgart, and the Dortmund fans, the away fans, won't be there for the first 20 minutes. They're staging a 20-minute protest at ticket prices. I think this will make sort of Premier League supporters a bit really upset them, really, because Dortmund are complaining at having to pay £15 to stand up and €15 to stand up and €29 to sit down. Now, I think most Premier League supporters would happily pay that, you know, for a big cup quarterfinal, but in Germany there is this. It translates roughly to you know, 20's plenty, which is what the English Premier League are trying to do, and basically, you know, that they feel that there should be at least some tickets available for €20, and that's not the case in terms of being able to sit down for Dortmund fans at Stuttgart tonight. So they're not going to be there for the first 20 minutes. I just don't understand why Premier League clubs need to put even more. I mean, I think that, you know, they're grotesque as it is, but to put them up even more, given the money that's coming into the clubs in the summer, just seems to be absolutely ridiculous. But I think the only way the clubs will ever listen, truly listen, is if people stop buying tickets. And at the moment, you know, you can do your protest, but you've already given the club your money. And I think unless you actually say, right, we're not buying a season ticket, we're not buying a match day ticket, and everybody sort of joins in, then I think that's your best hope. But for every time that somebody refuses to buy a ticket, there are four or five people queuing up to take that ticket. And, you know, I don't think there's sort of much unity, is there, really, at the moment. But it's going to need, I think, something on a major scale to really stop it, even if Liverpool fans are successful, you know, with this sort of battle that they've got going on. I think there's a more general issue, and I don't really see that being sorted out in the near future.
OK, pleasure as always, Mark. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Mark Langdon there. You can read his stuff in the Racing Post. OK, we're going to move swiftly on. 51552 for your text. Keep them coming in, and I'll get to them in a few minutes' time. But in a further development to the Liverpool walkout story that we spoke to with Eamon last night, supporters across the Premier League are meeting to discuss a coordinated walkout across all 20 top flight teams in response to the proposed increase in ticket prices. I'm delighted to be joined by Jay McKenna, who's chairman of the Spirit of Shankly and based in Liverpool. Jay, you're very welcome.
Thanks a lot.
It's great to have you on. Listen, first of all, what did you make of the reaction to the walkout over the weekend against Sunderland? Did you expect quite as many as 10,000 to kind of jump on board here, or what did you make?
We probably wouldn't have expected that many to have taken the decision to walk out. You know, it's one of them things because it had happened at such short notice. We weren't sure whether that would actually happen and whether, you know, enough people would take part to make a significant impact. But obviously they did, and for us it was pleasing that they took part and showed their anger and dismay at the prices. But a sad moment that you needed to do that in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did seem like that. You know, the pictures were beamed out all across the world, and it seemed that no Liverpool fans were taking pleasure in what they were doing. It was very much a kind of a needs-based action, if you like.
Yeah, it's a difficult choice for supporters to have to do that. You know, you pay to go and watch your team. You want to go and watch Liverpool Football Club. You want to go and support them. You know, if you wanted to get off early in matches, then, you know, you wouldn't have stayed for a lot of games. You'd have left going, we've been playing badly and stuff like that, but that's not what you do as a football supporter. But you know, given the circumstances, it was a very difficult choice, but I think a very necessary one that supporters have to make.
Can you just give us an idea then what we're talking about in terms of the prices here? So, you know, it's been widely touted. £77 has been mentioned as the figure that Liverpool want to put up as a ticket price for next season. But can you put it into context? What are the average ticket prices to go and see Liverpool as it stands at the moment?
Well, as it stands, the highest price ticket is £59 at Anfield, and that's available for six matches. And tickets probably range somewhere between the £38 mark right through to £59, depending on the opposition. So there's not too big a range between them.
Okay.
Liverpool plan to introduce the £77 ticket, which has received a lot of attention, as you mentioned there. But also, they've put up a lot of other ticket prices as well. So, as well as this, you know, of those that have increased from where they are currently, you know, there's tickets that have gone up to £55, £62, £64, £65, £71 and £75 as well. Season tickets have gone up. We've got a season ticket in excess of £1,000. And when we've looked at the numbers, basically on any one match day, there'll be 19,000 people inside the stadium who've paid more than what they currently pay now. And that's grossly unfair. And worst of all, what the club have done that's, I think, really angered supporters is they've actually made more money from tickets. So not just made more money from those tickets and knocked it off the rest, they've made some slight reductions, made some significant increases, and actually make £2 million more than they would make if they kept prices as they were.
And with the money that's in the game at the moment, particularly in the Premier League, with the new television deal to come in, I mean, this just seems bizarre timing, and it just seems like a real slap in the face to the fans. And obviously, they feel so strongly about this.
Well, yeah, exactly that. It's an unnecessary step. It's an unjustifiable step. And it's an unfair step. And Liverpool Football Club, you know, should seriously reconsider the prices because, you know, as Saturday demonstrated, supporters don't like them. And supporters just don't think it's needed. I don't know anybody who's looked at these price increases and plans and thought, oh, yeah, that's a really good move by Liverpool Football Club. You know, everyone's, you know, similar to you, is slightly incredulous as to why they'd need to do this now.
So what's... Do you think you've made an impression, Jay, overall? Do you think that actually the message has or is beginning to stick now?
Yeah, I think that Saturday will have surprised Liverpool. Liverpool will not have expected that. Nobody, the owners or the executives, will have expected Saturday to happen the way it did. I don't even think they were expecting supporters to be angry at the prices, which to me just shows how much they misjudged where supporters are actually at.
Wow.
So I think we've made an impact on them now, and I think they've actually looked at this and have realised, you know, we might have got this one wrong.
I was reading the points made in one of the pieces in the Telegraph earlier today that Manchester United supporters could go and watch a football match at Old Trafford for £3.50 in 1990. Even with inflation, that's still only £7.50 today. And the cheapest ticket at Old Trafford today is now £31. That is a massive jump.
Well, this is the problem with football tickets. You can have the debate about whether Liverpool's price rise, about how wrong Liverpool's price rises are. But ticket prices as they are currently too expensive. They're already, you know, the £59 tickets at Anfield, the price and people out are unaffordable to many. Particularly when, certainly in the last 20 years, ticket prices have gone up at an unjustifiable inflation busting rate. You know, they're well above where they should be. You know, most people you speak to, you know, even from, you know, the early 90s, talk about going to football matches. Going to football matches costs the same of doing many other, you know, pursuits. It costs the same as going to the cinema. It costs the same as going to the pub for a couple of pints. It cost, you know, it was a sort of a regular but affordable, you know, expense. Now it's not. You know, talk of £59 or £77 for a match ticket. You know, that's 1 day's pay from the average earnings. And, you know, in a city like Liverpool, you know, the UK's national average earnings aren't what the average earnings are in a city like Liverpool. You know, someone earning a minimum wage or just above minimum wage, you know, they're going to have to work for 2 days just to afford a match ticket in some cases. And that's, you know, that's just absurd. At a time, as you say, when there's so much money swilling around the game.
I think that there's obviously, you know, I think judging from the reaction that a lot of the other Premier League clubs were almost inspired by what Liverpool did at the weekend. And it seems now that there is a very real possibility of the 20 Premier League clubs joining together from a fan's point of view and staging something in the very near future as a show of unity. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, we'll talk to supporters. We will talk to supporters of other clubs and ask them about, you know, what they want to do. I think, you know, the thought of other clubs maybe taking action might be a slightly premature one. I don't know where they're at. And also, some of the clubs aren't doing what Liverpool Football Club have done, so ask them all to take this action. Some clubs have got, you know, very affordable ticket prices, you know, and very good ticket policies. Others, you know, have decided to freeze their prices, and supporters think differently about that at other clubs. Certainly at Liverpool, though, you know, we're unhappy with it, and for us, this is just the start.
Okay, well, look, it's been brilliant to talk to you, Jay. You know, how do you think they'll get on tonight, by the way, against West Ham?
Another win, 2-1.
Okay, good stuff. Listen, thanks a million for your time. Appreciate it.
Cheers, thanks a lot.
Super Bye. Stuff. There is Jay McKenna, and he is involved in the spirit of Shankly Liverpool Supporters Club. It's quite an emotive issue when you break it down, Gary, right? And you put the figures on it. Okay, we're sitting here saying, okay, £77, 60. What does that actually mean? And Jay is saying, look, actually, you know, this is a day's wage for the average Liverpool supporter over there, and they've been asked to fork out one entire day's work to go to see their football team, a team that they love and support, and they want to. It's just incredible. It's amazing to me.
I think the frightening thing is that the way the prices are going up, considering the revenue increase next year, they should be going down. So the scary thing is the fact that they're going up. Like, they should have a nominal price now to get into grounds, because the gate receipts aren't in the big drama that there once was. I mean, the last team next season is getting 100 million quid. Yeah. So you finish 20th. Like, you got to say Liverpool, worst case scenario, the way things are going, will finish probably top seven next year. You know, so they're going to make probably 120, 30 million anyway. I find it baffling when there's been so, you know, the disconnect is now getting wider between the owners and fans, and it's wrong, really.
Almost €99, £77, in case you're wondering what the exchange rate
to watch out. Rubbish.
€100 a game.
But to watch rubbish. It's not like they're top of the league and flying.
It's unbelievable. And the owners burying their heads in the sand. We're going to come back to this story, but a couple of texts. I bought one adult, one child's ticket for the Chelsea's home match against West Ham. This is in the family section, close to the dugout. Total £59, not too bad, but I'm not going every week. Chelsea's most expensive ticket is £70 for the PSG game. Another text in from Mac, who says, greed is all it is, lads, and it's very hard to disagree with you, Mac, on the basis of what we've heard. And fair play to Liverpool fans standing up for ticket prices. Other clubs will be watching with interest. From Rob and Enniscorthy, love the show. Thanks for that, Rob. 51552, keep them coming in. And we're back with Gary and Golf after these.
Do it. Play that again. It's the sound of the nation. 2FM.
Couple of texts in on Paul O'Connell. Paul O'Connell, thanks for being a Munster man. Thanks for being an Irish man. You're our hero. Enjoy the retirement, says Eddie. Hi, lads. It's a terrible shame Paul O'Connell didn't get to finish with the French adventure, but how proud we can be of the player and the man besides. Agree with Mike Prendergast. I think we'll have too much for France this weekend. Also, because I feel it comes too soon for Noves developing the side, they will give us hairy moments, obviously, especially in broken play. Overall, though, we should get the job done, says Barry in Cork. Thanks for that. 51552. Keep them coming in. Apologies there for the mic. And also, we will, just in relation to Temple, know we're going to speak to Pat Spillane tomorrow about the win over the weekend, because it was a massive result and we'd like to revisit the story. Now, you know, Murphy's Law, or Murph's Law as I call it, you know, the one time you don't put up Medeki Matsuyama and he goes and he wins.
Yeah, and he won in style as well.
He sure did.
And there was, what, about 100,000 people shouting for Fowler, and basically Matsuyama's manager and caddy, and that was about it, shouting for him. But I mean, he took down Jordan Spieth in Japan 2 years ago. He won the Memorial. He's an outstanding player. He's been on my radar since 2013.
A long time.
I backed him in 2013 at 6-1 to be leading player in the US Open. And then the bookies got it way wrong again. He was 6-1 in the Open Championship to be leading Asian player. And he was 175-1 that week. So I've been all over him for a long time.
What is it about his game that you like?
There's been an issue for many years. I mean, Jumbo Ozaki was the main guy out of Japan, but he's a bit like Guinness. He doesn't travel very well.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Japanese guys were like that. Because remember that big bet that I called last year in Morocco, Iwata, the Japanese guy, who was like ranked top 50 in the world, plays in Morocco, and he was 100-1 that week. And I'm thinking, this is the bet of the century. And he was 81 the first round and withdraws. But Matsuyama has something different about him. He played in the Masters as an amateur. He made the cut. He's won. He turned pro. He won four times in his rookie season on the Japanese tour. He's a winning mentality. And he saw that putt he hold in regular time to get into that playoff.
Mm.
He just has that inner steel about him that champions have.
Because people were criticising Ricky Fowler for his decision to go for it on the drivable par 4 when if he was two shots clear at the time, an iron, two irons into the green, take your medicine and off you go. But I suppose like Matsuyama still had to close that gap.
Yeah, he was two shots clear, but if I was pulling the clubs for him, I wouldn't. There's no reason for him to hit driver down there. It was a front left pin.
Yeah.
The
bad game management.
The problem with that green is if it's the back pin, you can't really lay up because you've got to lay up down the left. But, Shane had 3 wood into 15 feet. And Fowler is as long as Shane. But he got unlucky with the bounce. But you do get unlucky with bounces when you hit the wrong club because that's just what the game does to you.
Yeah.
But I think, another outstanding performance for Fowler. Just goes to show it's hard to win. But, that would have been his fifth win in 9 months, and the others haven't done that.
Yeah.
The kind of big three as such.
But he's really getting that level of consistency now that he could challenge.
Yeah, he's gone from, a closed horse and a bit of a show pony to, he is now the real deal. And it's taken a little bit of time, but he's a super player. And Matsuyama's 4 years younger than him. He's only 23, Matsuyama.
Yeah. Keep an eye on this guy.
I mean,
what about Bubba Watson then? Because he got a lot of stick from the fans based on his pre-round interview in the first round, in fact, when he basically said, look, I'm here because my sponsors asked me to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't like the course. They made too many changes to it and it doesn't suit my game anymore. I thought that was, enjoyable honesty for me sitting at home listening to him talk about it. But obviously the fans didn't take too kindly to what is a favourite tournament around those parts. Where do you stand on it? Does he have a point?
He doesn't really have a point because you have Phoenix Open where you get those 500,000 people come through the gate. And okay, it is nice and it's rare nowadays that sports people are honest, but badly
timed. Just shut up and get on with it.
The same. And he went to the French Open and he's staying in the Trianon Palace in Versailles. It's just...
And he says it's a basically...
It's gravy. He went around to McDonald's to dinner every night. So that's kind of what you're dealing
with.
And
then he said he didn't like France.
Yeah, he didn't, yeah.
So I mean, that's not just Bubba Watson though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But people
will boo him, I suppose, and he's just got to get used to that. If he's going to say stupid things, you got to get...
Yeah, but the problem is he doesn't realise they're stupid, so...
all right, this week, what are we looking out for? Plenty of Irish in action.
Yeah, we've kind of both sides of the coin, really. We've a Shawnee Open in South Africa, which is back down there after the Middle East swing, and first appearance for Peter Lawrie this year.
Okay.
Kevin Phelan and Rory McGee. So it's, a big opportunity for the guys to try, make some sort of an impression, get off to a start, get their up on the order of merit and get going. Exciting time for Rory McGee, who doesn't have a full card, who's coming off a good year on Challenge Tour last year. So it'll be curious to see how he does. George Gasset is defending. It's his home course. But I really fancy Charles
Schwartzel. Yeah.
He's a crazy price. We'll have to get on to Leon about these prices, but... they seem to be getting shorter and shorter for favourites. Like last week, Rory was 2-1 to win Dubai, which is bananas. What,
Peter Lawrie, you mentioned over Christmas that you felt, talking to him, that he just needed a bit of a break, clear his head and try and get some of his game back, and that the best way to do that perhaps was a bit of a break. He's had a bit of a break now. Interesting to see how he deals with that.
Yeah, golf is it's a sport that, at the professional level, as much as it is for the weekend golfer, it really just immerses you and it's almost impossible to get away from it. And Peter has been, banging his head against a brick wall for about 2.5 years, and that just wears you down.
Sure.
So I'm delighted to see him take a little bit of a break and just go back out and try and enjoy it. And it sounds kind of trite to say that, but he needs to try to get back to that stage. That's the whole reason that we all started playing golf, because we enjoyed it, or any sport you play.
Look at Shane Lowry. Look how much he enjoyed that last round. I mean, even though he wasn't, you know, he was...
Well, the thing with Shane is, like, he smells the roses, you know, and that's important. He's out there and he's enjoying himself. Now, people say it's easy to enjoy yourself when you're making a lot of money.
Yeah.
But he's making a lot of money because he's allowing himself to enjoy the ride, and that is the difference. You see a lot of pros with pain, you know, pain in their face playing golf, and
that's why people listen to us, Gareth, because we like what we do. We come here with a smile on our face every day.
Absolutely. And, you know, and then you have a situation on the other side, Laurie trying to get going again, and then you've Paul Dunn, just, I mean, he'll be enjoying himself this week. He's in Pebble Beach, you know, it's a celebrity pro-am. He's, you know, life is great. And
any fancies for Pebble Beach before we leave it?
Patrick Reed, I think, is a good bet. I've a sneaky for Bill Haas. I don't know why. And Schwartz will definitely in Shawnee. I think David Horsey is going to be tough to beat as well.
Okay, Gary, great stuff as always. We'll talk to you on Thursday. Thanks for your time. Okay, we'll leave it with Bill, who has this text about the main man from today. Paul O'Connell has an intense stare equal to Roy Keane's. If he asked me to jump off a cliff, I probably would out of fear. But at the same time, he's the kind of man I would follow into war. Thanks for the memories, Paul.
Game on 2FM, weekdays from 7.